Want a recipe for success? Step one, visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. Step two, click on my link to browse OCD Training School's amazing course catalog. Step three, enroll. And step four, enjoy learning. With no added cost to you, you can support the OCD family community while grabbing some continuing education or learning how to bridge yourself to self-help strategies for OCD. Again, that's OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And use my special link to sign up today.
Hi, OCD family community. We are smack dab in the middle of November, which also happens to be smack dab in the middle of our OCRD series. And today is all about digital hoarding. So join me for part three of this series, because this episode is about all things hoarding with our special guest expert and esteemed researcher, Dr. Nick Neve. Intrigued? Join us, because there's fascinating learning ahead.
I'm Nicole Morris, licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health correspondent. And let me be the first to say, welcome to the family. The OCD family, that is. I am here to create a community of support for family members, spouses, partners, parents, adult children, as there may be adult words, and chosen family of OCD sufferers and their community. I've had over 22 years of experience in the mental health field, but please note that this information does not qualify or substitute as a diagnostic evaluation, therapy, or treatment, and it is presented on an as-is basis. Please follow up with a qualified mental health provider in your area regarding concerns for yourself or loved ones. Thank you for joining us today. Now, let's get started.
Alrighty, fam. Time is flying by, isn't it? It is that time of year, at least for our family, where there is really an accumulation of holidays and birthdays and concerts and extracurriculars that really take the driver's seat. And though often the days feel long, the weeks and the months just catapult us further and further into the year. It's wild. But November is one of my favorite times of year. Partly because in the region of the States where we live, we get to see all the fall colors on the trees and welcome the sweater weather. But also, I love November because each year I run my OCRD series, which stands for OC-related disorders. It's the time where we create these conversations for lived experience warriors, families, loved ones, and practitioners alike. And they are so helpful for expanding a better understanding and more hope for our OCRD warriors. So thank you for joining us, and you picked an excellent episode to learn along with the fam today, because we have the wonderful Dr. Nick Neve, PhD, out of the UK, joining us to help us better understand an emerging problem in our world, digital hoarding. And my guess is, like many of you tuning in, you're super curious to hear more or to understand what's the difference between having sums of data and hoarding data, So if you have questions like these and more, you're in the right place. But to better understand digital hoarding, we have to have a functional understanding of what hoarding actually is. And as Nick and I will discuss later in the show, media has not done a good job with this at all. So I'm going to tell you a bit more about Nick so that he can tell you more about hoarding more broadly, because then we can have a good and consistent foundation to springboard us into our conversation about digital hoarding. So Dr. Nick Neve is a professor of psychology and the director of the Hoarding Research Group at Northumbria University. With well over 100 publications and continued participation in current research, Nick has helped to create the only digital hoarding measure I'm aware of called the Digital Hoarding Questionnaire, otherwise known as DHQ. And as I continued to see Nick cited across a spectrum of work with respect to digital hoarding fam, I reached out and I crossed all my fingers and all my toes to see if he would be up for a chat with the fam, and Nick graciously obliged. So without further ado, let's meet Nick, because there's so much interesting ground to cover. Well, welcome back to the OCD Family Podcast, and today I am so pleased and appreciative to have Dr. Nick Neve. And he is a researcher and an expert in the field of hoarding. And you're absolutely cited throughout the literature. And so the fact that you're here with us in the fam, I'm so appreciative. So thank you for coming and joining us today.
Absolute pleasure. Always great to talk to different people. You often hear some interesting angles and viewpoints that really do have a feedback into the research, because, you know, doing research, it's often very academic and there's not enough input from people with lived experience and from people with a wide range of different experiences as well. So it's always, always interesting to have a chat with different people.
I love that, because sometimes people listening, the fam here, can go, what can I do to impact research? Yeah. The researchers are there. They're doing this amazing work through different institutions, often universities and different academic realms, grants. And it's like, yeah, but I mean, they're measuring what? They're measuring life that's happening out in the wild here. Yeah. And so that feedback is helpful. So I'm so excited. And you are so accomplished in the specialty of hoarding as is. And I was wondering if we could just start today. Just giving a broad overview for maybe listeners that are newer to understanding hoarding or only have ever seen a show, Hoarders, and they're like, I think it's this.
Yes.
Can you give us a broad overview for starters on that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, essentially, hoarding's got several characteristics and these are very broad, so it doesn't always fit to the same person. But in generally speaking, a person who hoards has accumulated too much stuff. And I know at the moment we're talking about physical stuff. We're going to get onto the digital realm later on. But at the minute, a person accumulates an awful lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem is we all do that.
Right.
We've all got too much stuff. So if you said to me, how do you differentiate somebody who's got a lot of stuff to somebody who hoards? That can actually be a really quite subjective thing, because we've all probably got too much stuff. And if we all lived in bigger houses, we might never notice that we had too much stuff. So, you know, it can often be down to the size of your house. But if those possessions start to take over your life to the extent that you cannot do the things in your house that you technically should be able to do, then it's considered to be a problem. So, for example, if you can't use the shower because the shower cubicle or the bath is filled with stuff, if you can't sleep in your bed at night because you can't see your bed because it's got too much stuff on it, you know, if you can't use your kitchen, if you can't prepare food because every single surface of the kitchen is filled with stuff, that then begins to indicate that there's a real problem there, because the amount of possessions you have is starting to impair your quality of life. And then we find that things can get really quite dangerous, really quite fast. People, it depends on the kinds of things that you possess, but if it's rubbish, if it's foodstuffs, if it's animals, there could be a real disease element to that problem. If it's a huge piles of newspapers, then they can topple over. And sadly, we've had cases of people being crushed to death because of their hoard. There's a fire in the property that can cause real problems. So people can very quickly find themselves in danger. Their health suffers. They tend to be very then withdrawing from society. They tend to be embarrassed. They tend to feel stigmatized. They tend to feel vulnerable. So they don't let people in. And this is a particular problem with people with families, for example. You know, if they're a dependent children, the children don't want to have friends back because they're embarrassed. You know, and so it can easily, very quickly spiral into something which is problematic. So it's having too much stuff, it's not being able to get rid of that stuff, and then it's having this clutter that can then become a real problem.
Yeah, and it's such a great point that even how we define clutter is somewhat subjective, but how is that affecting your ability to function, both in your functional space, just practically? Yeah. And also just function in your home, functioning your school or work, functioning relationships, et cetera.
Yeah.
So it's such a great point. And it is hard for people to understand sometimes a lot of the collection of this stuff has a very vulnerable, sentimental extension of self for people. So like for one person, they're like, why aren't you throwing away what I would objectively call trash? And they're like, this is a part of me. It's got a meaning for me. And throwing that away would feel like I'm throwing part of myself away. And so it is hard for people sometimes to understand that mindset. And so if we take this a step further, what we're going to be talking about and focusing on today is digital hoarding. And you know what, fam? You're going to hear about digital hoarding and you're going to be like, maybe I do that. Maybe we know a lot of people that have some patterns or lack of intentionality about how we organize our digital data. But this is going to be, I'm hopeful at least, this is going to be an emerging conversation and an emerging real focus in the research. And Nick, you are such a leader in that. And so as we start to go into the digital realm, if you can help the family here understand, what do we mean by digital hoarding? And I know that it can kind of be sifted into some different categories. So
I would love
to hear more on that.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, really, it's the same kind of idea that you've accumulated too much stuff. Now, if it's in a workplace scenario, we're typically talking emails. Yes. So if anybody opens their work email browser and look at how many files you have in your inbox, you know, that gives you a rough indication as to the extent of your digital hoarding. Now, it's the same with physical hoarding. There's no set number. Mm-hmm. There's no magic number that says, oh, above this point, you're a hoarder. Below this point, you're not a hoarder. It's really take a look. Can you see everything there? And does it all make instant sense to you? Or is it a complete blitz of too much stuff that you can't remember, you can't fathom, you can't calculate,
right?
You know, and if you look at your desktop and there's icons all across the front of it and you can't find one that you're looking for, there's a hint there then that you have a potential problem. If you're getting too much stuff, you can't get rid of it, and then it's starting to have an impairing in your function. You can't find that file, you can't find that email, you can't find that picture because you've got too much stuff. It does indicate, not necessarily, but it does suggest that you're having problems with digital hoarding.
Yeah. So for some folks listening, they may go, maybe they have ADHD or different executive functioning challenges. Maybe they're just not thinking about how to organize it because in the moment, they just need to save the file. They need to save the work. They're taking a picture of their kid and they want to put it on Instagram, whatever the thing is. And so for some folks, they might go, well, what is the difference between just being messy and starting to collect these different things or have like, you know, a screenshot that now I have like a mess of icons on my desktop? Yeah. And so what would you say to that?
Again, I think it's that point where if you can do that instantly, quickly and effectively, it means that you don't have a problem. And I know people with thousands and thousands of emails, but if I say to them, oh, can you find that email from so-and-so? Yes, click, 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 there you go. Mm-hmm. They've got it well organized in their head. It's not having an impairment on their functioning. Mm-hmm. If you feel overwhelmed, and we did some research with our students, we asked students about their digital hoarding. We got a measurement of how many emails they'd got, how many things on their desktop, how many music files, how many picture files, blah, blah, blah. The ones that had, we thought, are really high numbers of this, they were starting to feel really quite pressured and stressed about it because it's overload.
Yeah.
We have digital overload. People feel overwhelmed. There's too many things to think about. It's slowing you down. You feel depressed when you open your email file. You feel nervous. You feel stressed. If it's having an impact upon the way that you work or function or study, then it's probably digital hoarding.
And you can see how the data management, cloud accounts, you know, even the new iPad with what are they in terabytes of storage now? I mean, it's insane. Why would you ever need, like as a parent or your average person, why would you need a terabyte of storage? And a lot of times there's stuff that you could just go delete out and create more room. But as you and I were discussing before we started recording, it's not exactly an easy and intuitive process sometimes to even get rid of older stuff, you know, finding it, putting in the trash, actually emptying the trash, like things like that. And so there is also this culture of more storage will just fix everything.
Yeah.
You don't have to manage it a different way.
No, that's right, because it's easy. It's taking away the stress and the anxiety of having to make a decision.
Yeah.
Because, and we hear this in people who hoard physical items as well, you go into the room and you say, look, do you really need this newspaper? It's 10 years old. Oh, no, I don't need it. And then they get terribly upset. oh my God, what if I throw it away? And it had that article in that I really, really wanted to read. It probably doesn't, but they are so terrified of getting rid of something in case they make a mistake, in case they regret doing that. And it seems to be the same with digital hoarding. People might take, you know, 10 pictures of the same group of friends on a night out. There's tiny differences between those images.
Right.
But the stress of getting rid of one and, oh no, it was the right one. It was the perfect picture.
Right.
I made the mistake, and people are terrified of making that mistake, getting rid of the wrong thing, then feeling guilty, then feeling stressed, then feeling anxious. They get caught up in these cognitive loops of worrying about getting rid of something and then feeling terrible if they have got rid of something in case they've gotten rid of the wrong thing. And of course, 99 times out of 100, you haven't made that mistake, but people are terrified of doing that.
Right. Yeah, it makes sense. I will admit I've been guilty of subscribing to e-newsletters or something before because they send coupons every now and then. And then when you subscribe to the e-newsletter, you realize, oh, I'm getting flooded by these emails. And maybe the coupon lasts for like 9, 6 days, whatever, a week, right?
Yeah.
And so then you think, like, how long? And I have to intentionally tell myself, go clear out all those emails. Or if I haven't used it in a certain amount of time, I'm going to unsubscribe because I'm obviously not in need.
Yes.
I can always resubscribe. But in the situation with digital hoarding, it is so hard. It's not to say someone that may struggle with digital hoarding can't do a process like I just described. But that attachment and the fear and the anxiety with... But if I miss something and then I need to buy something and I don't have that coupon and that. And, and I think a lot of it, too, is such a subtle slow boil of what danger is it if I have however many emails to this local shop around the corner just sitting in my Gmail or Hotmail or Yahoo or whatever. And so, so in thinking about some of the dangers that do come up. And anytime we're talking about impairing functioning, we already look at that cost that is created around our ability to have healthy relationships, to maintain work, school status, etc. And like you described in physical hoarding, there's some real safety concerns too. If you have an accumulation, fires, sometimes first responders, I know here in the States, first responders, there are some coalitions because certain units are not going to send their first responders in to save someone if it's too dangerous.
Of course.
You know, but there's that, there's mold, there's all sorts of different health problems that can come up. So what are some of the challenges we're facing when we look at those dangers in a digital sense?
Yeah, I mean, very, very similar in the sense that firstly, it's the impairment of functioning, especially in the work setting. If you've got 35,000 emails, if you've got all these folders and files that you don't want to get rid of, you then it's very difficult for you to find them again.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult for you to work effectively if you're having to spend hours every day trying to find things, trying to find evidence, trying to do that. You know, so it really does hamper workplace effectiveness. I mean, secondly, there's an issue there for cybersecurity. Do you really need all those files? Do you really need all those emails? And often what people do, of course, is they'll have a USB stick. They'll put all of these things. Oh, they're so terrified of losing them that they'll put USB stick. They'll put them onto a laptop. The laptop gets stolen. The USB gets stolen. And that's okay if it's you and I sending emails to one another. But, you know, there could be some really important information there that your company really doesn't want to get out there.
Right.
So it's easier to be hacked. It's easier to lose things by, you know, misadventure. And of course, then there's the storage. And we blissfully ignore that, but that costs money. There is a carbon footprint. There is an electricity demand for all these servers. And servers are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And the bigger they get, they have to be cooled. And that costs money. And we're constantly told about improve your carbon footprint, think about sustainability, think about eco-awareness, think about being more green. And we all want to do that.
Yeah.
But it's actually very difficult when you log on to work every day and there's another 100 emails there.
Right.
And there's another set of files that somebody sent you that you don't probably ever need, but I'd better save them anyway because just in case I might have to prove that I've seen them or done something with it. And so we're all saving all of these things, and that goes somewhere. And so more and more servers are being built to cater for more and more bits of information, and that the carbon footprint mounts up. Every email you send has a carbon footprint, so send it to one person. But most people go, oh, I don't want anybody to miss out, just in case, reply to all.
Right.
So one email goes to 100 people when, you know, maybe two people actually need to read it. And that's got a carbon footprint. And none of us think about that. You know, if there was a little app on your screen that says, oh, you've just sent another email, that's another XX amount of carbon, maybe we'd think a little bit more about it. Maybe organizations would think a little bit more clearly about, do we really need all of this stuff? Because it's got to go somewhere. It doesn't disappear, even if you press delete. It doesn't necessarily disappear finally. It's somewhere.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, part of the move with being more eco-friendly, maybe people are going to become more paperless. They're thinking less packaging. Yeah. But it's really drawing an important point to data. It's still leaving a footprint. There's no such thing as really package-free, even if you're doing it paperlessly.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. And so even some education, not only for the companies and businesses, which also good luck. I mean, it's going to be a hard market to break into, but also largely for us as consumers, because you can get an email about the new organic, non-toxic product, but you have 100 of those emails that you collect over time. And you don't even realize how you may be contributing to that. So I don't say that or point out that to scare anyone, but I think that awareness is half the battle. When we think of true hoarding, and something you and I were both talking about also before we were recording, is how when it comes to hoarding, it's a tricky disorder.
Yeah.
Because the level of, we could describe this and you might go, oh my gosh, that's my mom, that's my sister, that's my husband, that's my daughter. But it's hard for people that are struggling with it to see themselves in there because they have good reasons why, Nick.
Yes.
They have reasons, see? They have justifications on why this is important.
Yeah, of course.
Right? Right? And so can we talk a little bit about what we understand? I know that there is more research needed on this, but to the extent that we understand what's going on with hoarding and how do we build or understand insight in linking people to treatment when we are facing some of these challenges?
Yes, that's a very tricky one. I think if we knew the answer to that, the cure for hoarding would be there.
Yeah.
I think what we've got here is a very, very complex mental health condition. The problem is, it's actually normal. If you think of people who are minimalists, people who have nothing, they're the strange ones. They're the really, really kind of weird people, because the 90% of the population, or even more, we all have possessions. Mm-hmm. They're important to us. They're meaningful to us. We form very strong attachments to them. They tell a story. They remind us of people who we know. They remind us of our family. They are our personality. We express our personality through our bookshelves and our record collection and our movie collection and all of our items. We wear clothes that tell a story about our personality. We'll change our clothes depending upon this situation. So the vast majority of people, we all have possessions. They're all very, very important to us. So who are we to then go along to somebody and say, oh, you've got too many possessions. We think you should get those possessions. Let's come round to your house, Nicole, and you've got far too many books here, Nicole. Let's take them all away.
My husband might agree I have too many books. He might be like, yeah. Actually, though, it sounds relieving, folks, you know, to be like, oh, because we're always like, let's declutter, right?
Yeah.
But at the same point, who is someone else to come in into your space and be like, this thing doesn't matter. So this card, what's this card for? What are you going to keep this happy birthday card for? Yeah. Well, this card means something to me. Who are you to say this card doesn't mean something to me? Yeah. And so if you wonder how that would go over, just go on even social media. I'm older, so Facebook. And how many times have you convinced somebody that what they believe is fooey and that they should disregard it? It doesn't go well, right?
No, because it's completely normal. It's very normal for people to have stuff, and it's very normal for people to have probably a bit too much stuff. And the bigger the house you live in, if you've got a large garage or a large cellar or a large attic, you're going to fill it with stuff because that's what we do. So yeah. There's nothing wrong in that. The only problem is, as I said earlier, it's when it starts to impinge upon your life and when it starts to be a problem. You know, if you've got to open a cupboard, if you want to get something out of the cupboard and you've got to take stuff out of the cupboard to get to the thing that you want to get out of the cupboard, that's probably an indication that you've got too much stuff in your cupboard. Mm-hmm. Depends on how big your cupboards are, of course. But, you know, when things start to impair, do you really need two vacuum cleaners? Do you really need all those books that you've all read? Mm-hmm. You know, why are they there? Why do you need them all? Do you need 10 copies of that picture or that old newspaper that you've read or the magazine? Do you really need them? I mean, probably not. But again, it's really hard to come in and make a judgment call on other people's things.
Right.
Because they're not your things. How dare I go to your house and say, you've got too much stuff? That's none of my business. But it, as you said, it can become a problem. And especially if there are, say, children involved, then it can become a real problem. And it's very, very difficult then to say to somebody, you need to change. It's really got to come from within the person.
Right.
They've got to recognize that there is a problem. And what we run a hoarding support group for people who hoard in Gateshead in the Northeast. And people come along and initially it's like, well, I've been dragged here. I don't want to be here. I don't have a problem. You know, it's my stuff. I can do with what I want. And then they hear stories from other people. And some of the people have been there for a year now and they've gone on this journey and they've begun to have insight and to realize that when other people look at them, they're looking at them differently and thinking, actually, do I really need all this stuff? And so I think that insight is really important, but you can't force insight on people. It's got to come from within. And there are things that we can do to help people have insight to say, ah, actually, I might have a problem. But it's the same with everything, you know, drink, drugs,
right.
Other addictions that people have. People are very, very bad at understanding what's good for themselves until other people come along and tell them, because we're wrapped up in ourselves, aren't we? And it's very hard, especially we tend to find with people who hoard is that they're often on their own.
Yeah.
They often don't have a family or friends, or they keep it very, very separate from family, friends, and work colleagues. So in fact, nobody tells them. It's only when things spill out into the street or they have a fall, they call the medics, the ambulance people turn up and go, oh, blimey, this is a real problem. So it does tend to be that it's triggered by kind of a catastrophic event, and then the insight process begins to start. But it's tricky.
Yeah, which is why the portrayal of hoarding on a show like Hoarders, it doesn't sit super well with me.
I don't like those programs.
Yeah.
I started to watch them and I got very annoyed with them because they tell a very dramatic story.
Mm-hmm.
They don't seem to be done with the right
care.
Yes, you're right. There's a lack of empathy to the people. It's like, oh, look at these funny, strange, crazy, mad people. Let's see if we can help them. You know, that to me, that's not the right way going about it. So I avoid them. I find them offensive at times. And it doesn't match with reality as well.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about, like you said, a lot of folks that are in the depths of despair here with hoarding disorder are alone. They're isolated. And they also may describe their possessions, their environment as part of them. They're not alone if they're with their environment. Like there is that emotional attachment to it. And so it feels similar to seeing people kind of go in a home and if they were to take away their family and you were like, get over it. But look, you have this nice, clean kitchen now. And what happens for a lot of these folks when the crew leaves?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They're going to go back to accumulating stuff. They're going to feel like it's an invasion of their space, of their emotional space, too. And I feel like they are kind of just used as props in that show for entertainment value. And it's heartbreaking. And I will note, too, for family members, anybody that may be listening, you know, they've felt pushed and chosen over for items and things and have felt like, who's standing up for us? Well, these poor borders, this has affected our relationship. I can't see my mom anymore. Things like that. So there are really difficult aspects to this for the loved ones surrounding the person struggling with hoarding disorder, which has probably accumulated over time with most things, right? You know, it's going to snowball and snowball and snowball.
Yes.
And you can be like, 20 years ago, I noticed this. But we also know as people get out on their own, or maybe they get their first laptop and go to school. If we're thinking about it in the digital realm, that people, once they're off on their own, there's really an opportunity because it's not gatekept as much.
That's right. Yes. I mean, hoarding certainly starts in childhood, and then it kind of emerges properly in adolescence. But of course, as you've just said, there's the gatekeepers there. Parents will tidy your room. Parents will manage your life so that the clutter never becomes well established. As soon as a young person then goes out and stands on their own two feet, gets their own flat, gets their own apartment, moves in with, you know, a student halls of residence, then the behaviors start to manifest. And then what people do, of course, and people are very good at hiding things. So in other words, not their possessions, but they won't let people in. Mm-hmm. Or they'll accumulate more and more and more and more. It then becomes a vicious circle. They get a bit of satisfaction out of getting hold of something. That gives them a bit of a buzz and a bit of happiness. But then they look at their surroundings. They feel then quite depressed. So that makes them feel sad. So they then go and buy something else, which makes them feel good. And very, very quickly, that clutter has become a real problem. And then people are so embarrassed and they feel real stigma and shame about it that they really don't know where to turn. And it then often there's a catastrophic event or kind of a key event that forces them into doing something about it. One of our attendees at the hoarding support group, he was doing this. He was in his 40s, 50s. He'd accumulated so much stuff. His relationship had broken down. His house was so full that he had to live at work. Mm-hmm. But then there was problems at work. He lost his job, and then it all came to a head. And then he was forced with the realization that I do have a problem and I need to go and start to try and find some help. And it is a shame that people, we've just done a project looking at help seeking in hoarding, how people feel that they can go and ask for help and who they can turn to for help and how they do it. And we tend to find that people are so embarrassed by it that they can't seek help. They often don't know where to go. Where do you go? And you'd think, oh, well, everybody goes online now, but those can be very impersonal. They can be out of date. If you live in a certain part of the country, you might want somebody who's local, who's near to you, but there might not be anybody nearby. Mm-hmm. And so people do feel that they are alone and that people don't understand them. And I think those programs that you're talking about are often really bad because, oh my God, people will think that I'm that crazy hoarder from the TV program and that's not me, but I'm so ashamed and I don't want to seek help, but I need help. And people really get lost and they slip under the cracks and they get to the point where they are really at rock bottom, which is terribly sad.
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely heartbreaking. And it's part of where I feel kind of the sensational representation isn't representation, but it reinforces a harmful stereotype.
Yeah.
And so again, if you're a family member of someone with hoarding disorder that's like, but I have felt neglected over stuff, or the importance, the priority here hasn't been me, it's hard to hear things like, oh, this poor person is hurting so much. You know, what about me? What about other people in the family? And I will say, at least in my understanding, and you and I were talking about this earlier too, a lot of people that might even come in for treatment or even access treatment aren't coming in typically for hoarding. They're coming in because my daughter is really upset with me. I have strained relationships. I'm feeling depressed. Yeah. And you can find through the process that, well, and I got my medication refill. I can't find it. Well, what's the situation? Well, actually, I'm having this, you know, build up. And so we think about that in the physical realm. But this can happen in the digital realm as well, where we can't find the pre-authorization paperwork. We needed to send in this or that. And I don't even know if you guys
with like the NHS have to deal with authorizations the same way we do here in the States. But there's plenty of documents or things that we can just lose in the midst. Or did I even Absolutely. Have this plan? Yeah. So now I'm paying for another plan. And yeah. I have three plans that do the same thing. And I'm now that's a financial loss. It's yeah. clutter. It's there are so many different ways that that can add up. And so in the digital realm, I think especially as things continue to change so quickly, and now we have AI everything. Everything has an AI yes. arm, right? Yes. Which is interesting because you don't even necessarily need all the things you used to have. You could just create it and manifest it. AI will do it for you. But in the process, you know, I was telling my husband, I'm going to do this episode on digital hoarding. I'm really fascinated mm-hmm. and grateful because I have a leader, an absolute leader on this in Nick. And he was like, but what's the difference between that and just not paying attention? Because we accumulate a lot of this stuff, but it's growing really quickly. And like, who's
yes.
paying attention? So what would you say to the accumulation of data that comes from not paying attention, and when that can approach a threshold where it might be functioning more as hoarding as a disorder?
Yes. I mean, we did some interviews with people from different organizations. We gave lots of people the digital hoarding questionnaire. Mm-hmm. We found people who scored very highly. We found these were people from different organizations. We interviewed them to basically find out more about the motivations, the reasons why, the barriers, and all this kind of stuff. We actually found there's different types of digital hoarder. Now, the type that we're concerned about here, it seems to be that some people have that personality characteristic whereby they feel that they have to have control over everything. They have to have it. They have to know what they've got and where it's kept and how it's organized. And then they get overwhelmed as well. There's a group of people called overwhelmed digital hoarders. And this is a particular problem in workplaces where they get bombarded with stuff. And after a certain amount of time, they just give in and say, I don't care. I'm just going to keep everything. Mm-hmm. So they've always got too much stuff. The person who is the real hoarder, they're actually seeking it out. They'll download different things and want to be in charge of things and want to be in control. And they've got too much stuff as well. So if you just look at their inboxes or their kind of desktops, they've both got too much stuff. But the reasons why they've got that stuff is different. And until we really understand the different personality types and the reasons that are driving it, we can't generate apps, for example, that are one size fits all because, you know, oh, you've got too much stuff, let's just clear it. Well, for one person, they might go, yes, thank God for that. Get rid of it all. I don't want it. But the other person might be absolutely aghast that you've got rid of all that stuff.
Right.
So it's not just having the stuff, it's how people have got it, what they think about it, how they've organized it. And until we really understand that, and we don't fully yet, it's the same with physical hoarding. You can take two different houses, you can look inside those houses, you can give them a kind of a clutter rating scale of, say, 7 out of 9. They look absolutely horrifically hoarded, but the kinds of things that they've got and how they've got them organized and how they got them in the first place tells you a different story. And if you just try to score the same two people that those two people with the same thing, it probably wouldn't work. Here's an example. There's a member of our hoarding support group. Mm-hmm. They were identified by the social worker, and the social worker was very concerned by them because the property was incredibly badly hoarded. There was a real danger to them. They're getting elderly. You know, things were starting to topple on them. The gas people couldn't come to do their annual gas safety check. And the thing is, what happens there is people don't ask people. Very rarely do people say, what have you got this for? Why have you got it? How have you got it? Right. And when somebody actually then asked them, it turned out that all of the stuff that was in their house belonged to their parents. They were not a hoarder. They never went to the charity shops. They never bought anything really, apart from normal possessions. The only things that they got had belonged to their parents, and they loved their parents so much. They had such strong attachment to them. They couldn't bear to part with any of their parents' possessions. So when the parents had died, everything in this house had come into their house, and their house was a lot smaller. When they then got some grief counseling and they began to understand why they'd done what they'd done, and they began to separate out, okay, well, that object really, really reminds me of my dad. It was his. I'm going to keep that. But all their furniture, I don't need that. And so they weren't actually a hoarder. They just happened to have all of these things. And until we understand why people have got the things that they've got and what it means to them, then we can better understand how to help people. And it looks as if it's the same with digital hoarding.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. And I absolutely agree. It sounds like such common sense too. Like, ask somebody why.
Yeah, but nobody does.
Because a lot of times, like you said, a catastrophe has to happen.
Yeah.
And then people come in and there's almost this anger. Why do you have this crap? Why do you have this is molded. This is half eaten and it's gross. This is, you've got bugs over here. And it can be just really punitive, judgmental, condescending. Yeah.
But often there's a safety thing as well. I mean, certainly in the UK, people who live in social housing, their houses are provided by the local authorities. Mm-hmm. And the local authorities have a safeguarding concern over the people. They have to make sure that the properties are safe. They send people out regularly to check those properties. So if a housing officer or an environmental health officer comes to your tenancy house and says, oh, there's a problem here, I'm really concerned about your safety, the easiest thing that they can do is to say, right, let's clear it to make it safe. They have a duty to make you safe.
Right.
The problem is, of course, that can then cause even more trauma because they're getting rid of all your possessions.
Right.
But they often have to do that because the floorboards have collapsed. The gas boiler doesn't work. There's carbon monoxide poisoning. They have to make you safe. They have that duty of care. Right. But it's got to that point where it shouldn't have. Somebody earlier down the line should have said, oh, I'm concerned about this person. Can we step in now to help them?
Right.
But there aren't enough people to do these kinds of jobs. It's things that maybe in the past would have been done by neighbors and families, and we've lost a lot of those community ties, which very sadly means that other people have to do those jobs and there's not enough of them and they haven't got the time. And, you know, it's a real shame. So again, people are being ignored and we're not helping them early enough.
Yeah. And there's not enough insight. And so even like in a digital hoarding situation where you have a higher risk of being hacked because of the amount of stuff that you've collected, you don't know if there's viruses or different things within that, or financial documents that someone hacks into your IP address and can get access to here in the US, Social Security, or, you know, different things like that. But also there's opportunists that are going to be like, we'll help you. Yeah. And then they also, you know, so people don't know always who to trust and who to build these relationships with, and they're overwhelmed. So it's easier to passively go, okay, I don't need to deal with the email. It's too much.
Yes.
Or to easily back away. And then you get, again, the rate at which data is kind of just flooding us is immense. So you came up with this measure, the DHQ, which is a digital hoarding questionnaire. And can you tell us a little bit about how you and your team came up with this questionnaire?
Yes, we used it as part of what we call the Digital Hoarding at Work survey, because that's a separate little questionnaire that asks about how many emails have you got, why do you keep them, blah, blah, blah. The Digital Hoarding questionnaire was basically, we took the physical hoarding questionnaires, which all relate to what physical objects you've got, and we tapped into the accumulation, the difficulty discarding, and the clutter. And we simply applied those to the digital realm. Mm-hmm. And we tested it out a few times and it seemed to work really, really well. We got people to sit down in front of their computer, look at their email files, look at how many files they'd got on their whichever drive it was, their kind of main drive. And obviously we started doing this at work. So it was predominantly emails. And we got this measure of how strong they were at digital hoarding. We then looked at how they scored on physical hoarding as well. And there was quite a lot of correspondence. People who are physical hoarders tend to be digital hoarders as well. But as we've said, at work, it's not necessarily your fault. It's the workplace that's doing this to you. When we then adapted the questionnaire, we've just published a new questionnaire looking at personal digital hoarding. We're asking people about the device that they use most often. For most people, that's phones. We've asked them about how many emails they've got, you know, how many music files, how many movie files, all these kinds of things. It's the same kind of idea. And it tends to be pictures when it's personal stuff.
Yeah.
But we think it's the same kind of idea that people are bombarded with stuff. They find it very difficult to decide what to do with it. They've got a terrible fear of making a mistake by getting rid of it. So they keep it because it's easy.
Right.
And none of the tech companies, whether it's work or personal, are offering any kind of help on this. They're not saying, hey, here's an email. Do you really need it?
Right.
You know, okay, they might say this is spam. That's probably all the help you're going to get. You know, when you take a picture, hey, you've taken this picture 5 times already. They look incredibly similar. I tell you what, we'll merge it for you. So you've got now one great picture. Would you like to keep that picture and discard all the rest? At the moment, that doesn't happen. And
right.
So people, very, very passive. People, yeah, I'll keep that. I'll keep that. I'll keep that. I'll keep that. I can't be bothered to sit down and get rid of that because I've now got 50,000 pictures and that would take me hours to do. I can't be bothered. Life's too short. You know, AI will sort that out one day.
Yeah.
Which it might, but not at the minute.
Right. And I don't necessarily trust, because there's a gain for businesses and whatnot for you to be holding on to all these different things, you know. When my kids were young, I would take I feel like a million pictures of what seems like the same shot to have this cute picture. And how often do you even visit the cute picture that was the winning picture, let alone the old storage of like these, yes, basically multiples. Yeah. And now you look at the influencer realm of so many people want to be, whether it's Instagram or TikTok or all of these different ways that people want to present their augmented reality to the world.
Yes.
And what goes into that augmented reality is a lot of data, a lot of gunk, a lot of trial and error. And do you throw out all the error or people keeping the error? Because what if I could use that later? So you can see how it just accumulates, and our culture does reinforce that more and more and more and more and more.
Yes. As I said, you know, the minimalists are kind of thought of as being weird and strange. And I mean, even people like Marie Kondo, who wrote that Minimalist's Guide, you know, she's come along, I think, later on and said, oh, I have kids now. I need to keep all of this stuff. She's kind of changed totally.
Uh-huh.
It really does. You know, those life experiences really do have an impact. And I think, I mean, as a species, we are geared towards other people. We have formed very, very strong attachments to other people and to objects. Mm-hmm. And it's in our nature to keep these things as memories, as things to remember to do. It's just so ingrained in the way that we live our lives. It's very, very difficult then to break that, because where would you draw the line?
Yeah. I just had this thought as you were saying that. I wonder if, you know, in looking back, because I wonder if the era of what we kind of classify as baby boomers here in the U.S. and Great Depression forward families, people went from having to stand in line to get a ration of food because there wasn't enough. There was that scarcity. And then now people wanted to provide better for their kids. You're going to eat everything on your plate. You're going to keep everything. And I feel like that's contributed to the societal compulsion to collect and preserve and keep, because we didn't have these things when we were your age. We didn't have these things. Yeah. And that generationally then continues to change people's attachment to things.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, even if we look back many, many, many hundreds of years ago, people were buried with grave goods.
Yeah.
I mean, these must have been incredibly important to them. It's often weapons, but it's also tools
and jewels.
Mementos, which probably remind them of children, of parents, of family. So I think we've always done that. I don't think this is anything new. It's just that at the minute, we are overwhelmed with things to keep. We can buy anything, absolutely anything. If you want it, you can go and buy it, or you can find it in a charity shop. And certainly in the digital realm, again, and I think this is even in the last few years, you can now suddenly find anything online. I mean, in the old days when IT first became used in work, it was literally an email tool.
Right.
Because you just couldn't send files. They were just too big. But then suddenly we've got files. Oh, and now we've got PowerPoint files. And now this photograph, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The more things that we can do, it seems to force us into more and more and more stuff.
Yeah. And when you think about all these things then running sometimes in the background, or even people with, you think of a smartphone or a computer with a bunch of tabs open, but on a smartphone, you know, you do a new search, do a new search. Have you ever gone through and looked, how many pages do I have? That is slowing down overall the process of how efficient this tool is for me. But so many of us are unaware, or are just like, time is a commodity and I don't have time for this, right? Yeah. So very quickly it grows and expands.
Yes, yes. And it's all hidden.
Right.
We don't know where it all goes. It's magic. You say, oh, these servers, I wouldn't know what a server looked like. Where are they kept? Who's in charge of them? Are they surrounded by blocks of ice to keep them cool? Probably not, but I have no idea. It's magic. It goes into the air, the cloud.
Right.
What even is that? I don't know what it is. How big is it? But where does it live?
Exactly. But you can increase your cloud storage for 99 cents. It's out of sight, out of mind. Great. Yeah.
Exactly. Out of sight, out of mind. We don't need to worry about it. We can carry on living our lives, getting more and more and more and more stuff and not having to worry about it until it becomes problematic. When we can't see our computer screen for icons, we can't find pictures because we've got 50,000 of them. You know, it's not until it becomes a problem, either at work or in personal life, that people even give it a moment's thought. And there'll be people now sitting, listening to the podcast thinking, oh, blimey, I'm going to check my phone. I'm going to look at my emails. I'm going to think about this, because they've never even given it a moment's thought because it's not had any impact on them.
Right. Or the impact is such a slow boil that they're like, oh, yeah, my computer lags sometime. Oh, yeah, this might take a little time.
Yeah.
But there isn't necessarily that recognition of where that is.
Which is the same for a physical order. That realization, we keep talking, physical orders don't have insight. Well, none of us do, because none of us really think about what we're doing.
Right.
And we kind of blame people. Oh, that person doesn't have insight. It's a problem. It's some kind of mental issue. No, it's not. It's the same for everybody. None of us have insight into what's going on, because we push it away. We don't think about it. Until something goes wrong, we tend not to have insight. And I think it's the same in the digital realm as it is in the physical realm.
Yeah.
Labeling people who hoard as not having insight, I think, is a misnomer. It's not strictly correct. I could be wrong, but I just think that it's something which applies to everybody.
Yeah, and it kind of reminds me of medical model language, where it's more of like, here's where you're not meeting our expectations.
Yeah, yes.
Right?
Yes.
And I say that as family. You've heard me even in talking today. Like, I also think of the insight struggle for a person that is the direct lived experience person with the hoarding issue, but also, and it's, again, it's not to say that people don't have struggles, but I think it's such a great point, Nick, that we're all human and we all have those same struggles. Like, it's so easy to sit there and point at someone else and be like, you're a mess on this, but we're all our own messes in a collection of ways. And so you were talking then about, you have this hoarding support group in person.
We meet in person. Yes. It's a face-to-face group. To have that personal contact and to sit in a room with somebody, I think it just gives you that much more of a personal feeling. You can give that empathy face to face rather than on a computer screen, which I think is much less effective. I'm not saying that online support groups don't work. They clearly do. We have very good evidence that they do. And of course, if you're separated over long distances, then they're absolutely vital.
Right.
And I think it'd been so helpful. But for our purposes in the Northeast, we've got this nice little face-to-face support group that meets on a monthly basis. and we're seeing real progress with people. And it's often just that realization that they're not alone, that other people have these problems, and it tends to be the same kind of problem. There's a problem in childhood. It tends to relate to the death of a parent or the loss of a loved one, you know, traumatic experiences or uncertainty experienced throughout childhood. Hoarding's then a coping strategy to deal with those. And it's typically feelings of grief, loneliness, lack of support, all of those things, which we all face. But for some people, hoarding is their coping strategy and it works initially. But then after time, of course, it stops working and people then get themselves into more and more problems because of the clutter that's been built up, and they get into a rut and they get embarrassed and they feel stigmatized and they can't ask anybody to help until there's a catastrophic event. Yeah. You can almost see it starting out, and what we're trying to put in some funding now for a project to look at hoarding behaviors in children, because if we understand it better in children, we can maybe nip it in the bud before it becomes an issue for adulthood.
Yeah, and even looking at the supports needed when it gets, like, when you're outside of that gatekeeping environment, how to instill some of that management or ability to connect and link to folks that can help you manage that situation so that it doesn't balloon out of control and feel so overwhelming that you do feel stuck and have to deal with these real safety concerns. So you run the hoarding research group.
Yes.
So for you guys, you're known as experts in hoarding, but for the average person that maybe lives in other areas of the country or around the world that are not even aware, maybe they're just dealing with the catastrophe or they have somebody moving back in proximity to their loved one and they're like, holy crap, I can't even get in the house.
Yeah.
You know, what tools, what advice would you have for getting bridged to the right kinds of support?
Yes, but again, that's a tricky one because often that support isn't there. Hoarding is very much a kind of a hidden problem. I mean, if somebody's got a really obvious mental health problem like depression, schizophrenia, there's lots and lots of online support services available to people. There's much less for hoarding. It's not as common. It's much more hidden, but there are out there. I mean, certainly in the UK, we have two hoarding charities. They have their own websites. We always direct people to them. They've got a long history of helping people. Mm-hmm. We're actually starting to put together our own website because we have something which is called the UK Hoarding Partnership.
Wow.
And what we've tried to do there is to put together academics, professionals. These are people who work with people who hoard and the people who hoard themselves. So we've tried to put those three elements together. And they're all help groups for people who hoard. There's very little advice for professionals and academics. It tends to be very niche and very focused. It's not broad help. So we're trying to create a website which puts all those three things together so that a housing officer, say, can log on, can find support and help that helps them maybe deal with a client who they've just found who hoards.
Yeah.
That an academic can go on and find links to various publications and to academic resources, and the person who hoards, we can direct them to the major hoarding charities, the NHS things. There's a podcast called That Hoarder, which we've directed people to, and they've been very, very helpful in understanding more about their condition from a person who hoards. So there are avenues out there, and they're getting better and better. And all we can do is really signpost people. And there's a lot of initiatives going on around the country where people are using the Buried in Treasures workbook created by people like Randy Frost, the great name in hoarding research from the States. Amazing work.
Yeah.
So people are using those textbooks or that Buried in Treasures to create their own little groups that are helping people along. So there is help out there. It's not always easy to find. And the problem with it, of course, is unlike, you know, some of the mental health conditions, there's not a pill.
Right.
It's not got that medical, because it's hoarding's just a person being normal, really, but just doing it, you know, too much.
Yeah. As with some of the other conditions that you were comparing hoarding to before and addictions and whatnot, if someone is depressed, is it something like them talking with their doctor, getting on an SSRI may be helpful? It's not going to fix the hoarding, but it might help decrease the intensity of the depression. And so it's part of that network. But like you said, a lot of times catastrophe is going to happen. Yeah. And then ... granting that they're safe enough to be able to continue, this is where intervention comes in, whether a person likes it or not. And so I know one of the things we do here in the States, there are plenty of task forces with emergency workers, because they're front line on this. They end up being, or these housing workers, like you said. But also I want to point out for listeners that it's not to say that a person in a certain social economic status is likely to deal with this. In a housing unit where it has to be maintained, it's being maintained by a governing program, someone's going to come search your house. But for a lot of us, nobody comes and searches our house. They only come in if there's, you know, a house fire or there's some kind of plumbing issue or something to that effect. And then they come in and they go, oh my gosh, what's going on here? And so it's just about that visibility, too. Like you said, it's such an invisible thing. We don't always know who's struggling with this, that we have some different areas where we might be able to more often than not come across these issues. But that doesn't mean this is a poor person problem, a rich person problem, or anywhere in between. This is a human problem.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to add all those resources to this episode's blog over at OCDFamilyPodcast.com so people can check that out. But if you are dealing with or have a task force in your area, whether you're a practitioner or you're a loved one and you're going, how do we manage this? How do we help? One of the strategies I would say, if there is a relationship there with your loved one that is perhaps having, whether it's a physical or a digital hoarding or both, like you said, even connecting with somebody, talking, not making it about the stuff or the collection of stuff, but gosh, what would be helpful in just feeling like you're less alone?
Yeah.
Would you be willing to talk to somebody about?
Very interesting. I think now there's so many more people that are willing to talk about their own experiences, people on Instagram, people on TikTok, younger people perhaps, that are much more open about these kinds of things. I think younger people are much more open to talking about mental health issues. Old people seem to be much less happy to do so. And younger people are often really, really driving this and are showing that it can affect everybody, that it's not just that crazy old lady with the hundreds of cats. It is everybody from every walk of life and from every background, from every creed and color. It is everybody. And I think there is much more growing awareness now online, and those resources can be fantastic. And that will only grow.
Yeah.
We're in a really exciting time whereby there are people starting to take action on this online. They are being incredibly useful because they've got the kind of lived experience, and they, you know, they've often got families and they've often got friends who are also chipping in on their podcasts and on their interviews. So I think we are in a kind of a good phase at the minute. Things are starting to happen.
I love that, because it ends us on really that hope, that foundation of hope. And I would absolutely agree. I look at Gen Z and beyond and I go, the ability to just talk about things is so beautiful, because it's not that, and sometimes you got to take things with a grain of salt sometimes on what you see, but the vacuum of I am the only person in the world struggling with this one very specific thing. And now it's a hashtag that I can link to all of these other people that are also struggling with this thing, help to let people know that they're not alone. And we are absolutely champions of that kind of that ideology, because we aren't alone. We aren't. I mean, even you and I here, you're on the other side of the pond here, and I'm over here in the States, and we're not alone. We can connect on these things. And so I so appreciate you not only taking the time to chat with us today, but all the amazing research that you've been doing and continue to do. And so I'm excited and hopeful for that website you were describing that kind of married those three different areas coming together for understanding hoarding better. But
I'll send you the link as soon as it's ready.
Oh, please do. I'd love
it's being built right now. We do have a website address. We're going to share it with our steering group. And when the steering group are happy that we're doing the right things and putting the right information in the right places, will then start to populate it. And it will, of course, grow and grow and grow as we expand. But it should hopefully be a good resource.
I love that. And is the DHQ, is that publicly available at this point?
What we aim to do as part of the website when we're looking at help for academics or help for professionals is to put a list of all the resources that we have and have them as a printable form that somebody can download and use. That's the idea.
Yeah.
Certainly. We want to make as many things available that people can use as we can, bearing in mind there are obviously copyright things for some things, but we'll try our very best to have links and things that are useful.
Excellent. So for now, in the waiting period while this website's under construction, if people were interested, maybe because I do have a sizable enough audience of practitioners that listen, if they wanted to check out the DHQ, again, that's the Digital Hoarding Questionnaire, would that
I can send people a version that they can use more than happily.
Oh, thank you. Okay, so I'm going to put a link. What would be the best way to kind of connect them your way?
My email.
Okay. So I'll have that on this episode's blog with the other show notes here. And if you want to reach out to Dr. Nick Neve here and ask for a copy of the DHQ.
Personal one as well. We have a work one. And well, we have the kind of generic one, which is digital hoarding specific, but we have a workplace version. We have a personal version. So it depends what you're interested in.
Yeah. Well, I'm just curious to look through them. This is also fascinating. So thank you so much for all the work that you do. Thank you for your time, which is such a gift beyond that to help the family understand this. And if you have a loved one or you yourself are concerned that maybe you're dealing with some of this as well, definitely check out more information over on this episode's blog where you can connect to more of Nick's resources and what we've discussed during the show. And thanks again, Nick.
That's absolutely been great. Yeah. Really enjoyed it.
Well, yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you for your time.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Intrusive thoughts.
Okay, fam. Okay, wow. What a powerful and, dare I say, insightful conversation, huh? How many of you were like, I can hear or see pieces of myself in that conversation, Nicole? And you know what? In part, if you did, then I kind of feel like Nick and I did our jobs. Because as Nick so astutely put, hoarding has a basis in normal human behavior. And like many mental health conditions, it's when normative processes exceed and start to weigh on us, on our relationships, when it starts to interfere with our functioning and or productivity, maybe at work or at school, at home, in social settings, now it's become a problem. And so I really like how he framed that. Because we can see ourselves in this conversation. So if that's you and you're like, yep, that gave me a few things to think about, join the crowd family. We're all human and decreasing shame and stigma can start with us. But also, we learned about how digital hoarding can increase vulnerabilities to cybersecurity, data breaches, financial waste, and even our carbon footprint. In fact, let me take a minute here to share just how significant that imprint has become, because this is a bit wild. A recent article published through Data Center Dynamics stated that, quote, the environmental cost of data hoarding, with data centers currently pumping out tons of emissions to manage global data storage, is equivalent of almost 2% of the world's emissions, which is the same as the airline industry, end quote. Sending emails and 747s putting out a similar footprint? I mean, that puts it in perspective for you. So if you want to read more about that, fam, I always have all citations and resources linked over on this episode's blog. So even though having a full email box or backing up those group chats might feel harmless, they function at a cost. And though they can have a mental weight, they also have a financial and environmental weight. So it's an important conversation on many levels. And like with many things, building awareness is half the battle. So for today's intrusive thought segment, which for newer family joining is my application segment of the show, I want to invite you to take notice of how data management, or lack thereof, is impacting your life. Are you signed up for e-newsletters for coupons that you've never used or expired months ago, if not years ago? Did one of the kids get your phone and take a photo burst or download a bunch of apps they used years ago or for yourself and you don't even use them anymore, but you keep running out of storage and it feels like you can't get by without offloading certain apps or upgrading storage? is your desktop a smattering of icons, saved documents, or downloads that at this point makes it too hard to find anything? If so, there's no shame. And again, to Nick's point, that doesn't automatically mean it's functioning at a disordered level. What becomes distressing or even to the level of impairing for me is different than what it's going to be for you. But how easily can we remedy this? How easily could we say, okay, I'm going to remove these unneeded pictures, these unneeded files. I'm going to unsubscribe from these mailing lists. Or if you're like, gosh, the thought of that alone, ugh, I can't. For fear or distress of losing something important, then I want you to notice that. There are resources available, but this is a hidden disorder. And in a more digital age, even though our global neighborhoods have gotten so much larger, we've suffered a grave loss in our face-to-face connection. So finally, whether you identify a concern for digital hoarding or not, let this be a reminder. How long has it been since you've actually checked in on your neighbors? Or a friend? Your sister? Your father's? Maybe reach out and create time for an in-person coffee or walk in your literal physical neighborhood. Because while it may not solve all the problems that any of us have, we do know that personal connection of this sort is a powerful resource. So let it be a note to remind us to love on one another in this way and for ourselves. Lastly, I'll just note for loved ones and chosen family, particularly for children of family members with hoarding disorder, there is a lot of pain and often rawness, maybe even trauma, involved in these sort of dynamics. And the impact this has had on you is significant. So I just want to reiterate and validate how difficult these conversations can be. And I'm going to link some resources that the International OCD Foundation has compiled in addition to what Nick has shared over on this episode's blog too. But please know, you're not alone. You matter. And we are better together. Thank you for joining me and our OCD family community. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please like and subscribe to the OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Did you find this content helpful? Please consider leaving a review. The more people that know they're not alone, the better. For more information regarding today's podcast, please visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com and remember to join the email list while you're there. It will provide you with the most up-to-date information, resources, and the down low on the family chatter. Oh yeah, nothing says family like Nick Neve and me taking on hoarding digitally. That's right, I went there. And you can too at OCDFamilyPodcast.com.
Therapists, are your clients struggling with disgust-based contamination OCD? Have you tried upgrading your ERP with the Mastery approach? Visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses and click on my link because I've got just the training for you. At OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses, you can check out OCD Training School's entire catalog of courses, including Rich Gallagher's course, Treating Contamination OCD. Where else can you build mastery over disgust-based triggers while supporting the fam at no extra cost to you? It's a win-win at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses.